I think everybody did pretty well on this one. And some of you are a little bit chicken-hearted about when you tried to put upper and lower bounds on things, you had them quite far away. But, you know, I understand, sort of. But anyway, that's in the first problem. In the second problem, pretty much everybody got the general idea, and a lot of you got it precisely correct. That was the one about the spring and fall. I don't think I'm going to spend a lot of time discussing that, because so many people came so close on that one that I will leave it. Okay, and your homework will be returned if you tell me your name.
Dorothy.
Yeah, Dorothy, okay. Got it. There it goes. All right. So, what we're going to do, instead of discussing the homework more, is talk a little bit more about pin selection, etc. And then I have, because we're running late in the course, I'm going to start moving on into mutation, talking about mutation. I showed you the this rather extreme two individual interaction. So only once in the lifetime of the organism there's this two individual interaction. It makes everything simple, and then you get out exactly Hamilton's formula. And of course, as you've seen from the homework, you know, I gave a case where you're interacting with, what, 10 other organisms, and you can see that it's not a subcase of that one. The one I showed you was a special case, but you can think about issues of fitness and the Hamilton's formula and try to figure out that case. There are other cases besides altruism that are important to which you can apply these formulas. And I have a list of them in the book, and I'll just sort of race through those. One of them is mutualism, in which the behavior, you have a behavior that's good for you and also good for others. And there, it's really fairly trivial to see that if you try to apply Hamilton's formula, there's a cost which has to be less than R times the benefit. Well, in that case, the benefit is positive, and the cost is negative, because the cost is a reduction of fitness, but the fitness is increasing in you, so you have no cost. I mean, it's not no cost, you have a negative cost. And in that case, of course, the formula will be satisfied, and the gene will spread. So people sometimes forget about that because of two reasons. One is that biologists are fascinated by cases where there is a conflict between the within species selection and the kin selection. But in this case, there's no conflict. They're working in the same direction. But the other is there will be selection for genes to cheat on things like mutualism situations. So you do have to worry about things like that. Please. It's the sum of the benefits to the others. So it doesn't include the effect on you if you're the individual doing the behavior. If it's something good for you, and it's good for some individuals who are on average relatives, then you have both a negative cost and a positive benefit, and the formula will work fine. There's also an interesting case of complementary behaviors, and this is one where individuals go out hunting. And let's say they go out hunting in pairs, and one likes to chase the prey, and the other likes to lie in wait, and then they share the kill. So the one is chasing towards the other and they ambush the prey. Well, you might have a gene that predisposes you to be the chaser or predisposes you to be the lying in wait. You might have different alleles for that. You could imagine such a case, at least. Well, how would it work out with Hamilton's formula? And the answer really is it works out. I won't try to do it by waving my hands at the formula, but what it works out is that you should go out hunting with the least related individual you could find. Because if you have the gene for chasing, you don't want them to have the gene for chasing too, because then nobody's lying in wait. So go around, you know, look around and find an individual that's not related to you and go hunting with them, because they're more likely to have the proper gene to do the complementary behavior. And finally, there's a case of what I call in here narrow selfishness, or sometimes I call it nasty selfishness, in which you do something that's good for you and harmful to the neighbors. And in that case, it turns out it's best if the neighbors aren't, you know, if you do this to less related individuals, because if you do it to enough closely related individuals, you're decreasing the number of copies of the gene that you have to do this behavior. So it will spread mostly when you're very unrelated. And the other thing I do in the section is to do a little warning about ways you can go wrong in thinking about kin selection. One is by, that I mentioned before, assuming that it requires conscious recognition of kin. It does not. The theory does not. Now, if you can recognize kin and target your altruistic behavior towards those recognized kin, that, of course, gives you a more favorable condition for kin selection. But it can work even when you have organisms that have no conceivable way of recognizing kin. And you sometimes find people making this mistake, including some very, very eminent people have gotten up and saying, the problem with kin selection is you have to be able to recognize your kin. And that's completely wrong. Okay. I've mentioned mutualism. Sometimes people will look at explanations for behavior and ignore the possibility of mutualism. But the really, really big one occurs when talking about humans, and that's ignoring cultural inheritance. Humans, when you try to explain human behaviors, well, you could make biological explanations involving genetic variation and kin selection if you want, but humans have a lot of behaviors that are passed on, not genetically, but culturally. That's an almost trivial statement, and basically it's includes all behaviors that behaviors having to do with schools, governments, law and families, contact with neighbors. And if you want to explain changes in human behavior over time in populations or differences in human behavior, if you're trying to explain why do the French speak French and the English speak English, you need not look for a genetic explanation. You need not do genome-wide association study to look for the allele for speaking French. You probably won't find it. Because, of course, there's cultural transmission in each country of the language. A trivial and totally silly example is that when I was a child, there was a cultural phenomenon that swept across the United States in the 1950s when I was a teenager. And that involved people taking large plastic hoops and putting them around their waist and then twirling the hoops, and it was called the hula hoop. It disappeared. It swept through the United States and other countries. Then it disappeared, and disappeared for some of the decades. And then, once again, it swept through, in the 2000s, I think. There was another wave of hula hoops. Well, somebody can get up and talk a lot about
the genetic component of cultural change and so on and so forth. But if you go up to them and say, are you really claiming that the fact that all of a sudden everybody was twirling hula hoops is because they had alleles for twirling the hula hoops, and these alleles had magically increased in frequency in the population from zero up, you know, to a high level, you know. The quick response to any genetic theory is don't be silly. That happened by advertising and cultural transmission. It didn't happen by genetic change. Biologists are very, very ready to assume biological explanations for everything, and they easily fall into the trap of biological determinism. And that is something that should be carefully thought about. And let me make one last comment about Hamilton's formula as applied to group selection. I mentioned that group selection was the alternative before kin selection came along. The difficulty with group selection is the scenario imagines that whole groups are disappearing and being replaced at a high rate, and that's often biologically difficult to imagine. But if you get group selection to work, one way of thinking about it is to think of it as a kind of kin selection, because what is required is, first of all, that there is genetic differentiation between groups. If all groups had the same gene frequencies, then killing some groups instead of others wouldn't make any change in the gene frequencies. So there have to be genetic differences in gene frequencies between groups. And that most easily comes about when there's genetic drift, and that means that the individuals within a group are non-randomly related to each other. They're more related than individuals who are in different groups. So in that case, there is a value of the coefficient of relationship R. The cost is obvious in a group selection argument, because the individual that displays the trait is losing fitness. The benefit is in survival of the whole group. So you have to make some sort of calculation about how often, and it's substantial the more often whole groups go extinct. So there's a whole bunch of individuals who could benefit, and there is a benefit in the sense of a lower probability of the whole group going extinct. So you can actually rationalize the whole thing as that when group selection can be made to work, it's because it satisfies Hamilton's formula. And there are a number of papers in the literature with mathematical models of group selection that do this analysis and show that the condition for group selection to work is, in fact, the same formula. So Hamilton's formula is applies both to kin selection and group selection. It's just a matter of whether the scenario for group selection is plausible, which sometimes it is, but a lot of the time, in a lot of cases to which people have tried to apply it, it's not all that plausible. There is no general rule that says that group selection is anti-scientific or crackpot or wrong. Group selection is a possible scenario that can work. So there's been, I mentioned it in the notes, there's been a whole lot of a recent dramatic controversy over between a number of people who are pushing group selection as the explanation for the evolution of social behaviors since about 2010, including E.O. Wilson, who was one of the people who helped publicize group selection in his book Sociobiology that was written in 1975. He's now changed his tune. At that time, he explained lots of things by kin selection. He's now changed his tune and taken up with the people who are promoting group selection. There are a lot of people who work on evolution of behaviors that are upset about that, and there was at least one paper that was published that had something like 130 authors on it saying this group selection argument won't hold water. It was basically sort of a petition that was circulated, and 130 people signed on. So people are feeling fairly strongly about that disagreement right now. Before we shift on to mutation, thoughts on anything involving natural selection, anything involving kin selection, anything involving your homeworks? Yes?
The value R, can it only vary between 0 and 1?
Well, if you think of it as the probability that, let's say you and I are relatives, the probability that a copy that I have shows up in you as a result of kin relationship, I think it has to be between 0 and 1. I mean, if it's a conditional probability, probabilities don't go negative. Now, if you think of it as a correlation coefficient, then the story changes. I'd rather not, for a couple of reasons. It would be too tangled, A and B. I'm not sure I have anything coherent to say on the subject. I'd rather not think about the correlation coefficient interpretation. But I would say, at least in that interpretation, it's between 0 and 1. Okay, yes?
For the question 1, how do we define the population fitness?
The population fitness.
Is it the number of options?
In question 1, in which homework?
Homework four.
Okay, I handed back 3, so I thought you might be referring to 3. In homework 1, is this the nest holes one, or is that the other one?
The one that we're going to try to find today.
Yeah, the one.
Yeah, due to the nest holes.
It's due there, but there are 2 questions due today.
Question one,
and question 1, you have to remind me, because I believe question 1 is the nest holes.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. you could think of the average population fitness being the average number of offspring per parent. These are clonal organisms. I made them clonal not because we see a lot of clonal organisms, but because it makes the math simpler. In that case, it would be the average number of offspring per parent. In a diploid case, you have to throw in an extra 1/2. But for an absolute fitness, and here we were having differences in numbers of offspring, and I didn't say anything about viability, but let's assume there are no differences in viability. Is that an answer to your question? Yeah. Okay. So let me start talking a little bit about the math of a mutation, which actually is very simple mathematics. And then we're going to quickly, as we can, get into the balance between mutation and selection. And when you have multiple alleles, and I'm going to consider at first 2 alleles, even though, of course, mutations are happening at the DNA level, and for the simple case of point mutations in DNA, there are 2 alleles, there are 4 alleles. But I'm going to give you a rationale for why it's okay to talk about the 2 allele case in a little bit. What I want to do is think of a case where there are 2 alleles. You might say, are we in a haploid or are we in a diploid case? And the answer is yes. We could be in either. It won't make any difference to this argument. There are 2 alleles, and there's a mutation rate from big A to little a, and we'll call that U. And we're also going to allow back mutation. We'll call that V. The real reason for using U is people used to like to use Greek letters, and the letter M for mutation in Greek is a mu, and then when somebody who speaks English sees a mu, they get it mixed up with the U. So that's why U would be. Okay, now if you have that and you have a population and in the current generation, the frequency of big A allele is P. Let me see. We're still looking for the right. Yeah, let's say P. Yeah, that's it. And the frequency of little a is 1 minus P. If a fraction U of the big A copies in the next generation has mutated to little a, and a fraction V of the little a copies has mutated to big A, what do we get? Well, the new frequency is of big A is those that were big A in the previous generation and didn't mutate. That's a fraction P of everybody in the previous generation, a fraction 1 minus U of whom didn't mutate, or individuals who were a little a and did mutate. So those are 1 minus P of everybody, and a fraction V of them did mutate. So there is the basic equation, simple linear equation, very trivial. Just counting the two cases and what fraction of everybody did what. And then you say, okay, well, what happens if you go on and on and on, generation after generation, with this happening? The answer is some of the big A's will continue turning into little A's, and then some of the little A's will be turning back into big A's, and where does it end up? Well, one thing you can do is say, is there an equilibrium of this process? And then how fast do you get to the equilibrium? And if there's an equilibrium, what we're going to do is call that the frequency of big A at the equilibrium state, it'll be P, but I'll put a little E on it for equilibrium. And the equilibrium state will be when this equilibrium value, if you start out with it on the right side and apply this equation, what you get out is the same value. Okay, so where is that? Well, you look at that. Simple linear equation, no square terms, no mysterious denominators or anything. So what do? Well, you just rearrange it. I'm going to do it over here because we're going to put something else below this in a moment. You just say it's PE equals PE minus PEU plus V minus PEV. And the PEs cancel out, and we group all the PEs on the left side, take them over to the left side, and we get, of course, PE times U plus PE times V equals V. Or the equilibrium is equal to V over U plus V. So it's the back mutation rate, that the rate at which big A's are created by mutation, divided by the sum of the two mutation rates. So if I have a mutation rate equal to 0.00001 forward and backward mutation 0.05, which I believe, let's see if I've done that correctly, yes. So it's half as great, then the equilibrium frequency is that or 1/3. So if you have a forward mutation rate that's twice the back mutation rate, the population will settle down to an equilibrium in the long run where 1/3 of all the copies are big A's and 2/3 are little A's. Okay. Now, how quickly will it get there? That's where taking these two equations that I wrote down, the general one for P and the one for the equilibrium, I can subtract them. I can say, how far are you from the equilibrium? And the easiest way to do that is just take those equations and subtract them term-wise and say, well, here's how far we are from the equilibrium after a generation of mutation. We look at this and we'll see P minus PE, these are the terms in 1, minus U times P minus PE, that's this term. Over here, we get V minus V, which goes to 0, and we get minus P minus PE times V. So I hope everybody can see where all those terms came from. So you got P minus PE in the right side times some stuff. And what I'm going to do is show that this is 1 minus U minus V times P minus PE. As every term has a P minus PE in it, we'll take it out and put it on the right side, and then you get 1 minus U minus V. Okay, so what's happening? The departure from the equilibrium is getting multiplied every generation by a number. This number is 1 minus the sum of the mutation rate. So in this example, 1 minus U minus V will be, of course, 1 minus 0.00005 minus 0.00001, 1 minus 0.000015, or 0.999985. So the departure from the equilibrium is multiplied by a number that's almost 1. It's just a little bit less than 1. So how far you are from the equilibrium will be almost as big in the next generation, except a little smaller. And the picture that you get, well, that's badly drawn. I'm not doing projections for this. Do some next time. Here's the gene frequency of big A. Here's time. If you started out with a population that was all big A's, what would happen? Well, there are no little A's to turn into big A's. The big A's can mutate away. So in fact, the frequency of big A will decline, but very slowly, because of the small amount of mutation away from big A, one copy in this case, 100,000 is mutating away. So the gene frequency will come down by one part in 100,000, which is, I can't even draw. Okay. Likewise, if you start out with no big A's, all little A's, then some big A's will arise, but how many of them? A very small number. In this case, 5 parts in a million. So 1/2 of 100,000. 1 in 200,000. So the gene frequency of big A will go up, but again, by a very tiny amount. Now you might say, okay, it's going to converge on an equilibrium. The equilibrium in this numerical case is 1/3. When will it get halfway there? And the answer is, well, it'll get halfway there when this 1 minus U minus V thing that's being multiplied every generation, when that gets to 1/2. So when there's a number of generations T, such that that is 0.5. You can solve for that in logs by taking logs. T times the log of 1 minus U minus V equals the log of 0.5, which, as everybody knows, is 0.693147. What's the log of this 1 minus U minus V? What's the log of 1 minus a very small quantity? And some of you may recall that the log of something very small, like 1 minus X, is nearly minus X. And then there's some quadratic terms, but they're trivial. So you could approximate this very, very well by taking that and replacing it by T times minus U minus V, or I'll say minus the sum of the mutation rates, equals, the log of 0.5 I gave incorrectly. a log of 0.5 is minus 0.69314. So 0.69314 is a log of 2. The log of 1/2 is minus that. So we have minus 0.693147. So the time you can solve for, the half-life, I'll call it T sub 0.5, is equal to 0.693147 over U plus V. The minus signs have canceled out. In other words, about 0.7 over the sum of the mutation rates forward and backwards, which here is 15 parts in a million. So that will be, in this case, 693147 over 0.000. I've got to be careful about how many zeros I have here. 1/5. And that is going to be, I think I will do that with the calculator. .693147 divided by .000015. And it is, the half-life turns out to be 46,209.8 generations. So you can see these mutation rates, which, by the way, I put in, are rather high mutation rates. They're not biologically, the mutation rate per site in the, say, mammalian genomes is about 10 to the minus 8, or maybe a little lower. I'm using rates here that are 10 to the minus 5, but you might say, well, why are you doing that? Why are you making it so much larger? And the answer is because I might be talking about a gene that has many sites, all of which can mutate. We'll get back to that issue in a moment. If I have that mutation rate, it still takes 46,000 generations to get halfway there. So what's going to happen is this gene frequency is going to approach sort of exponentially, I'm not drawing it very accurately, and getting halfway there, this point is about 46,209.8 generations. So you can see that the time to get substantially there is even longer. It's 100,000 or more generations. Because why? Because we have these very small mutations. You have to wait until essentially everybody in the population has had a chance to mutate. So the first lesson from this is that mutation rates are, if mutation rates are small, and they are, then mutation can move you towards what's called a mutational equilibrium, but very slowly. It's a very weak evolutionary force, and thus any little natural selection or anything else that comes in will have a good, will almost certainly change the gene frequency much more. On the other hand, if you don't have mutation, then the whole process of natural of adaptation by natural selection stalls out in the end because you run out of raw material. Fortunately, mutation is not something you can get rid of because it would require perfection of replication of the genes in order to have no mutation, and real physical processes can't achieve that perfection. The second law of thermodynamics alone will guarantee that there is some mutation. Okay. Now that we talked about that, let's talk a little bit about multiple alleles. There I have a whole section, and I'm not going to show you the formulas, but basically you can... you can write out a big table. You could have allele frequencies of multiple alleles. So P1, P2, P3, all the way up to P, whatever. It could be a very, very large numbers.
You can write out a set of linear equations of what is the frequency of the ith allele in the next generation, and the answer will be it'll be the sum over all possible alleles of the probability that you start in that other allele times the probability that you mutate from I to J. The whole thing can be set up in terms of matrices. You can get eigenvalues and eigenvectors. They come out with the same answer, which is whatever mixture of gene frequencies you start with, there is ultimately an equilibrium, but you approach it very, very, very slowly. I'm not going to go through the math of that, but it's doable. If you start to think about it, and you start to think about, then a useful thing to think about is a space of DNA sequences. You can think of all possible DNA sequences. So let's suppose we're thinking about a locus. And this locus has 1,000 coding, like 1,000, or maybe 999, but about 1,000 sites at which that are part of codons. So maybe you have 1,000 sites. And we say, okay, in that stretch of 1,000 sites, that might be the exons, how many alleles are possible?
4 to the 1,000.
Because there's 4 choices at the first site, and 4 choices at the second site, and 4 choices at the third site, and so on. It's 4 times 4 times 4 times 4, 1,000 to a total of 1,000. 4 to the 1,000. How big is that? Well, you can think of it as approximately, it's 2 to the 2,000. Now, I can do it more exactly, but I believe it is it's 10 to the something, so it's approximately 10, I believe it's the 6th. I think I have it in here somewhere. Yeah, it's about 10 to the 600. Okay, it's a little bigger than that. But what is 10 to the 600? It's a 1 with 600 zeros after it. Okay. How big is the universe? Okay. The visible universe that we see is thought to contain approximately 10 to the 80th elementary particles. So this is much bigger than the visible universe. It's if you took the visible universe and squared it, which means you took every particle in the visible universe and replaced it by an entire universe, you would get 10 to the 160, and you still wouldn't have come anywhere near 10 to the 600. And I could go on with that and try to give you, blow your minds more thoroughly. So if every particle in the visible universe were a DNA sequence and they all had different sequences, remember, every particle is being replaced by an entire DNA sequence. And the universe consists of nothing but DNA sequences. They couldn't possibly have all the different sequences that you can see in a stretch of not a whole genome, just 1,000 bases. Okay, so now, what kind of structure does that space have? How far are those sequences from each other? We now know there's so many of them, you couldn't possibly even have them in the universe that we've got. You couldn't have them all at the same time. You could never go to mutational equilibrium because there isn't enough universe for it. Okay. Now, if you think about all those sites, you can think about the fact that, you'll line them up. There'll be A, dot, 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 dot. The one where there are 1,000 A's, and then there's A, dot, dot, dot. Where the last base changes into a C, and so on. Put them out alphabetically.
and so on, all the way down to T, 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 T. And there are 10 to the 600, I'll put a little course there, of those. But any two of them you could imagine aligning and counting the number of differences between them. If you ask, if we have a given sequence of 1,000 bases, how many different mutations, single base substitution mutations, could it occur? Of course, the notion of mutation is very broad and includes base substitutions, but it also includes deletions, insertions, you know, all kinds of other crazy things. But let's just consider base substitutions. If you take one of these sequences and you say, well, there are 1,000 sites at which it can mutate, and there are three other possibilities at each of those sites. So there are 3,000 neighbors that are one base substitution away from you. If you take your 8,000 base sequence that you have and ask how it can mutate, there are 3,000 other sequences it can mutate to. So we can have to think of there being a graph of possible sequences that's got 10 to the 600 points. Each point is connected to 3,000 other points. It's kind of like you can kind of make an analogy. And by the way, you cannot draw this graph. First of all, there isn't enough marker pen ink in the universe to draw the picture of the graph, and let alone enough blackboard. Whiteboard, showing my age. But it's a situation like the famous 6 degrees of separation result, which is the result that says that if I take any two people in, for example, the United States, and I say, I want to go from you to another arbitrary person in the country, by going from you to one of your friends, and from them to one of their friends, and from them to one of their friends, how many steps does it take? Okay. Well, there's a famous experiment by Stanley Milgram, who was a guy who kind of did pop psych experiments and publicized them in the magazine Psychology Today. And one that he did is to get people to agree to participate in such an experiment, and then gave them very elaborately constructed envelopes and said to you, I want you to get this to a guy who is named such and such. He's named Joe Blow, and he is a carpenter who lives in western Massachusetts, in the town of Adams, Massachusetts, let's say. North Adams. I say that because we have a relative in North Adams. And what it is a whole set of envelopes inside of envelopes. And so what you're supposed to do is take a friend of yours who you think might be closer to this person. So maybe you know somebody who lives somewhere near Massachusetts. And you mail them the envelope. And inside the envelope, when they open it, it explains the whole project. And it says they are to record on the envelope who they were, and then they're to mail it to another person. And it goes and gets to Connecticut, and then it goes and gets to Massachusetts, then it gets to western Massachusetts. And it turns out that to go from any two people, between any two people in the United States, took an average of 6 steps. So that's the famous 6 degrees of separation result. And people have, there's more to say about that, and we've run out of time. But what I'm going to basically show you next time, and then we'll go on to deleterious mutations and what they do in a population, is that in a DNA sequence space that corresponds to it, no two sequences are more than 1,000 steps apart, because all you have to do is change every site and you can go to any arbitrary sequence if you know where you're going. So you have this vast, unimaginably vast space of possible sequences, but no two are more than 1,000 steps apart, which may sound like a lot of steps, but compared to the number of points in the sequence, it's it's not so great. So it's kind of like the 6 degrees of separation, but in this case, it's the 1,000 degrees of separation. And next time, I'll tell you about, briefly about the Erdős number and the Kevin Bacon number and my connection to them. But then we'll go on to, which is related to the 6 degree stuff, and then we'll go on to deleterious mutations.
Okay. I will have a new homework out, I hope today.